Greetings all. Now, something very interesting happened when I sent the slides, and I want to admit that I sent them, you know, last minute because as an academic, it is my right and privilege to make everyone else in the world crazy because of my inactivity. So I've given away a bit of the punchline already in the cover. So my title for today is the talking about being the publisher of the community with the subtitle of We're All Doomed. This came from, as I was putting together this talk, as I was putting together this presentation, as I was thinking about what I could contribute to the notion of information being put out there and scholarly access to information and how we can look at content distribution and how the web has changed. It's very easy to run down this nice little rabbit hole of all the things that can go wrong. And so I'd like to, of course, indulge in that for a moment, if you'll allow me. And then hopefully we can find something on the other end. So with that, let's see if I can make things go happen. Oh, yeehaw. So the first thing that I'd like to discuss, and I think is becoming probably obvious from all of the different sessions you may have seen, is that we're really in the midst of a death of documents. And what that means is not that we are producing less documents, God help us, no, or that we're producing, you know, less information. We're pumping this stuff out like crazy. And now the best part is, since it's all digital and electronic information, we can attach all this assessment and data gathering to it. And so now we can have documents that generate tons of data and tons of data that generate more documents that then we evaluate and you see where this is going. So that's not what I mean, right? This isn't a question about, you know, we're all going to go back to being an oral culture and the internet will simply become the tribal flame that we all gather around. But it's more the idea that what is a document, and while that many people will tell you it has been a fluid definition throughout time, right now is particularly fluid, to the point of melting. This morning, I have the great honor and privilege of teaching our incoming LIS students, so the future librarians, and we marched over to our library, and we went up to our sixth floor, and we sat amongst the documents of special collections. And as is done, you know, passing around, this was a piece of Elizabeth I's collection, and here's a Bible with a silver binding. We don't have, as far as we know, any human skin books, but we know that they're going to be there somewhere. And you look at these documents, and they're this amazing history. But even then, the curators will talk about the idea that they have a regular discussion about what is a book and manuscript and what do we collect and how do we collect it. So even the idea that we know what documents are is a bit of a fiction. But it's a fiction that we've built entire industries around. It's a fiction that we have built around a publishing industry. We have built very much practice over the last 200 to 300 years of librarianship around. We believe that we understand what documents are. We've organized and come up with methods of organizing them, of sorting them, of classifying of them, of circulating them, of securing them, etc. But what we find is when print becomes digital, something really amazing happens. And that is that digital is ultimately a much more flexible plastic environment. And so we get, you know, where we might have talked about editions beforehand. Oh, this was a fabulous book. And then they wrote the second edition and the third edition. At least we felt like we had at least, you know, a year. Please give me a year between the editions. Now the idea is, well, you know, let's change this chapter and let's add this chapter and let's bring it on. You mentioned the Atlas of New Librarianship, which was a wonderful book that was published in 2011, but we finished writing it really at the end of 2009. And we handed this manuscript over to a MIT press, which is a fabulous, fabulous academic press. And they looked at me and they said, we're going to streamline this. We want to get this out. We're going to put it on a 13-month production cycle and it'll be ready to go. And I just, you know, it was a phone call, but I think they could even see my face go, you're kidding me. But this is what it takes to produce a beautiful document, well edited, thought through. But now we have this idea that we can put things out and then let's change a chapter. Let's add a chapter. Let's change, ooh, there's a wrong footnote. We can do corrections in text instantaneously. We know that we can recall books even without consumers' consent and bring those books back in and change them, etc. So we've really seen the death of editions. We've seen the living document really become important. And with it, we've seen that terms then that we're so used to in the classic sense of content distribution and consumption really become metaphors. I mean, e-journals and e-books are neither books nor journals. The idea that what is a journal? Well, you know, starting in the 15th century, it was a way to democratize and really create an open forum for communications that we could share scholarship beyond personal correspondence back and forth. And over the centuries, we have determined what works and what doesn't, and we begin adding indexes and page numbers. That sounds like an interesting idea. But now we're trying to figure this all out again, and the first thing we're trying to do is make it look like we used to. Now, everyone here has sat through at one point a lecture, and I promise this is not a history of the book lecture, where we talk about the idea that we are trying to put new information, new digital information into old analog bottles and things need to evolve. Yes. So I'll leave it there. But just to understand that as we go through this, things get more complex, right? So when these terms become metaphors, e-journals and e-books, neither books nor journals, we see instant updates. We then begin to see that we are exploring new functionality. I mean, just before us, not only were we talking about the idea of embedding video, we talked about before about embedding documents within courses, which themselves are documents. We're seeing that we can begin to take advantage of digital content in a whole new way, and it creates real interesting problems for us, as it were. We can, you know, we remember the days when you would argue with an editor of a journal about whether you could get a black and white picture and how big it could be. And then we talked about maybe adding color. And now we're talking about linking to terabyte data sets. This is different, right? We're also seeing the idea of embedding functionalities within it. So accounting books that can count, that we have, you know, when you teach people how to use spreadsheets, we can embed that spreadsheet functionality right in there. We can guide people step by step. We used to teach our incoming LIS students, and I'm willing to admit this, basic HTML. Of course, back in the day, we used to get undergraduates jobs paying $30,000 a year because they knew HTML. Oh, the good old days. But now, the idea that I'm going to sit down and teach you HTML in a class is crazy when I can send you to Code Academy and you can type right into the web page and it can directly tell you what's right or wrong and verify your code as you go. This has changed how we write and construct texts. This has changed how we teach courses. And this has changed very much how we look at what's embedded. I mean, am I the instructor, or is now course, is Code Academy the instructor? And what functionality can I do or not? We've also seen that the idea of these flexible containers, that just because we have content and we put it on paper, we can easily turn that into a PDF file, which can turn into HTML 4 and 5, which can turn into a text file. Bottom line is, we're all doomed. As we go through this, and as we continue to explore what we can do, when we take away so much of the old impediments to what was a document and how could we do it, we run into all these really fascinating and, frankly, unsolvable problems. We see this notion that, you know, just taking this one step further, when ebooks that we have now are going to become apps. I don't, you know, if you paid attention and you were there with the first Kindle, and Kindle, you could bring up a text, and the first thing people noticed with the Kindles was, where are my page numbers? And what do you mean a spot ID? And what is that? But then suddenly I could put my Kindle down and pick up my phone and I was on the same place, and both of that was really interesting. And then Apple decided that this was a cool market to get into, and we all held our breath hoping for the next Steve Jobsian revolution, and they came out with Apple Books and we all went, okay. I mean, it really was a rather unimpressive change of format. I mean, we could add prettier pictures and put it on an iPad, but not much move forward. Whereas you look at the Institute for the Future of the Book and you look at a lot of the experimentations going on, we really are looking at an evolution where we're leaving the book behind and calling them apps. The idea from children's books to textbooks, embedding functionality and by doing so, creating choices. Choices that we never had before. I mean, we can talk about publisher lock-in all we want, but that's nothing compared to the walled gardens of when your textbook only works on a Kindle, when your, you know, important medical text will only work on an iPad. This is a very different thing. We've locked down content, and we've locked it down to both format and content providers, when the underlying technology should allow us to burst through and go in all of those dimensions. What we're finding is that people are putting an artificial friction in the process. They're creating restrictions that the technology itself allows us to overcome. So we're now seeing that the idea of a document-like object disappears. And not only that, but if you then look at folks who are trying to get past the walled garden, if you look at some of the technologies presented today, they bring up this whole new interesting problem. What happens when we have content and within it, it's got a visualizing text? So we were working on a project with the National Science Digital Library at National Science Foundation, and they had a huge thing on molecular study so that people who were looking at molecular chemistry could actually bring up molecules and in a 3D visualization spin and play and have a good time with them. Well, that's great because it was all open and it required a series of APIs, application programming interfaces, and you could get the 3D thing working until the grant funds run out and the API goes down. Until that document that you thought you had that existed in the cloud didn't have any sort of maintenance plan and it disappeared. Before, you know, the idea of special collections and archives and duration begin to evaporate because what's starting to happen is when we look at what we can do, we're instantly looking at all the capability on the cloud, which is brilliant and wonderful, but we're distributing functionality like crazy, and we're distributing the functionality without the necessary infrastructure to support that functionality over time. That visualizations occur and then the visualizer disappears or the data formats change. We look at distributed metadata, but we're relying on an authority file that simply goes crazy one day or changes hands or changes URLs or has to move from our, you know, MARC records. Now we have RDA and we're able to look around these different files and then suddenly it goes a little crazy. We look at annotations and we realize that pretty soon what is a primary document, what is a first order document, and what are those second order annotations begin to flip around so we don't know what's happening. So in essence, we're doomed. This idea, once again, that we keep moving through all of this technology and what's happening, and suddenly we're creating brilliant, amazing systems that work for the duration of attention span and pocketbooks of those who utilize them. And that's a very different world than working in a document world, working in a fixed media world. And it's one that I think becomes increasingly complex as we seek to do increasingly interesting things with it. So if we just take one example and we look at the notion of a footnote, maybe footnotes are annotations and annotations are context. And one of the things that I'm going to sort of pick up again a moment is that context is becoming increasingly more important than content. So we look at this annotation and we say, you know, what happens when annotations become the primary document and how can we tell the context from the content? So in the scholarly world, footnotes do more than simply add a little space and a little formatting. It really is our ability to integrate a current thought into lots of other thoughts. Citation patterns, citation systems, the way the citation works, whether how you do it, who's citing whom, all of this becomes important. And as we've seen in, you know, scholars like me, and we look at the tenure track process where tenure itself turns those annotations, those citations from a second order object to the primary review, they can be examined on their own world. And so how do we look at this web of connectivity? And once again, we say, oh, well, Dave, we're on the internet. Google has shown us that the power of citations works fabulously well. Until we realize that we're living in a world of URLs and not URIs, and that things move and shift and who's citing whom and why change dramatically. So once again, we're all doomed. So this is fun. I'd just like to end here and walk away and cry for a while, but that would be counterproductive. Because I think the other thing that the reason you go down this rabbit hole and the reason it's getting easily lost and the reason that we have events like these two-day events and these speakers are to show that, no, we're not necessarily doomed. We can do high functions within this environment. We can do really cool things, and we can do interesting things, and we're breaking through the containers, and we're coming up with some of the solutions. But one of the limitations that we're going to hit and that I just want to sort of move my conversations to and my remarks for today is that what we're going to hit is not going to be a technical barrier. The problem that we're going to hit and the problem that's already showing itself and the problem that we're sort of experimenting with and dancing around is not the notion of what is a document, and it's not the notion of a digital container, but really we need a whole new way of thinking about content and content delivery, which is to stop thinking about content. And I know that sounds weird, but stick with me for a moment. We need to see the sea change. So I'm going to present a sort of, you know, armchair version of looking at library and information science over the past four decades. And there has been this rather massive shift. And the first part of that, which I'd say was predominant primarily through the 20th century, is a collection focus. That for a long time, we looked at content as a series of documents, and we looked at the caretaking of those documents. So we built large collections. We looked at publishers, and they had large catalogs, and they had warehouses, and we delivered these things, and we worried about the completeness of those collections. We worried about the storage of those collections. We worried about the classifications and the specializations. And that collection focus served us very well, particularly in the days when the collection focus was not out of hand. We saw that a really interesting thing happen around World War II, where before World War II, and I'm talking for hundreds of years before World War II, there was a relatively functional infrastructure of content production, content collection, and content organization and dissemination. We found a way to do it through libraries, public libraries, academic libraries, special libraries, subscription libraries, and through publishers, both in professional societies and not-for-profits and for-profits. And the idea that there was the gatekeeping function that happened all over, we sort of accepted it. It was great to be a white male landowner throughout this whole process, but we sort of understood how it worked. So publishers realized that they had to limit, based on the amount of money they had, the amount of expertise, the amount of time, the materials that they put out into the public world for consumption, out into the marketplace, and that libraries could utilize that parsimony to collect comprehensively, to get information, to make it available. Problem happens around World War II is that paper suddenly gets really cheap and ink gets extremely cheap. And suddenly we could produce seven titles where we used to produce one. And publishers began to realize that if I produce seven and one of them hits, I'm still ahead of the game. And I'm more likely to get two of them to hit, and that's even better. And so they began to expand the number of titles produced. They began to expand new marketplaces. They began to expand in the production of information. And I think this, by the way, on the whole, was a very good thing. We got into new communities. We started talking to people we hadn't talked before. We started talking about different topics. Scholarship evolved to the point where they could dependably take very esoteric topics and produce them out for greater consumption. The problem is that infrastructure for collection, archiving, dissemination, document perspective, where libraries would get these things and they were still in a comprehensive mode. And so they kept going and going and going and going. And one of the images I like to show, it's not here, so don't look for it, but one of the images I like to show is, you know, the modern conception of a library is a book palace full of materials bursting through the rafters and around columns and every square inch filled with materials is a relatively modern invention. If you go back into the early 20th century, you go back into 1920s and 19-teens and such, you actually find relatively small collections and huge rooms full of reading rooms and people consuming, utilizing that for scholarship, for learning, for advancement. You see, even in the closed stacks and chained libraries, when those materials were sparse, the libraries were there helping take sparse resources and turn them into new knowledge and new information. And that disconnect happened right in this sort of cheapening, broadening of dissemination, and we kept going. And this collection focus kept going too and became much more at the forefront of our minds. Because now we were talking about cataloging, and cataloging had to become copy cataloging, because if it didn't, we just simply could not keep up. And we started moving from the idea of collections and quality to efficiencies and effectiveness, and we started dealing with grabbing more stuff and figuring out how to put it in faster and faster. And eventually this model is breaking. This model is breaking around us every day. And it's breaking also because at the same time we smashed it wide open with digital content. When suddenly you walked in and you said, by the way, did you know that since you have internet access, the entire internet is part of your collection? Now, today we say that we yawn, but in 1993 and 92, when you said that, librarians would look at you very crossly and say, no, 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 no. That is simply a service over there in the corner. I mean, it was kind of like story time at an academic library. It's like, well, we have it. We just don't like to admit it. And now we've sort of embraced it and we said, oh, and I remember the days. This is where I get to play old Dave. I remember the days when we used to create MARC records for websites. I remember the days when we would do highly selective systems and we would only collect certain websites. We'd only point to them. And then Yahoo began and we all figured out 13 categories that we could organize the world with. And this collection focus, it just made it so painfully obvious that this collection centrality was wrong, that this wasn't how the world worked. The National Science Foundation found this out in a very interesting way. They created something called the National Science Digital Library, working with Cornell. We were part of it. Lots of folks came in. And they said, we're going to fund two groups. We're going to fund one group, and you will be the collection group. Your job is to go digitize and make stuff. Make those 3D molecular diagrams. Digitize those Confucian texts. Create science materials and science lesson plans and et cetera. And over here, these will be the services and we'll fund them separately and they'll do visualization and they'll do search and they'll do all discovery, these kind of things. And 3 years into it, they said, great, now bring them together. And so they said, collection provider, please provide me your collection. And the collection provider said, here it is, here's a URL. And by the way, you should know that we organize them alphabetically and et cetera. And suddenly the service folks said, no, that was our job. What do you mean you organize them? And they said, well, how do you create a collection without organizing them somehow? I mean, chronologically, at the very least. And suddenly it became dawned on many of us that we sat and said, you know, there is no such thing as a collection without a service. Organization is a service. Access is a service. When a library opens its doors and lets people browse through its materials, that's a service. And it's a service that we invented, right? In the old days of closed stacks, in many parts of the world with closed stacks, and many parts of the U.S., there are still closed stacks where they don't have or offer that service because they can't support it through security, through manpower, through time, whatever it is. So we began to see this collection focus didn't work. We really needed to move to a service focus, and that is the idea that cataloging is a service, metadata creation is a service, and it's a service that we may consume internally, but it's increasingly a service that we can offer externally. When a faculty member now comes in with a 10 terabyte data set and says, help, we can say, well, you know what? We have ways of organizing and indexing and finding through that. We have statistical tools to data mine. We can look at how we archive this over time and provide limited access to ensure ethical use of your data, etc. These are suddenly tools that we've internally consumed that we now see as a service that we can provide. Browse, collection, archive, reference, questions, data mining. All of this. Then we see, for example, if you look in the larger higher education context, courseware, education, lecturing, context provision, these two are services. And so we then moved to a service orientation, and we looked at the moving from outputs where we counted things to outcomes where we see if things count. Right? We moved from the idea of how many volumes does a library hold to how many engineers do we graduate that can actually do the engineering. Those kinds of shifts are a service focus. We see it, for example, in information literacy standards. As we talk about what students and faculty and librarians and professors and business people and eighth graders need to know, they need to understand how to search information, determine its origin, synthesize it together, evaluate that process. Information literacy has taken us from a world of teaching you how to use the system to teaching you how to think. That's a service orientation. And so we're in this sort of world of a service orientation. Even our vocabulary, when we talk about things like APIs, when we talk about things like consuming, when we talk about things like data mining, when we talk about things like taking content, bringing it into a course management system, highlighting its commercial or cost or what have you, providing video access on demand instead of having to store them, etc. We talk about them as services. We talk about them as software services. We talk about them as metadata services. We talk about them as interchangeable services. We talk about them as discovery services. We live in the era of services. And I'm going to argue that that is a great leap forward. But I'm going to argue that it's not far enough. because it doesn't fundamentally change the fact that we're still talking about consumption. Services have users, people who come in and use them. And we talk about this in a world of consumption, that we consume this metadata service and we consume this collection and we bring it in. And that the professor may be able to very easily check three things they want in their course and it magically appears. Or that the student can go in and watch the videos on their own time, or can read the article when they need to, or a researcher can consume these different kinds of bibliographic services and Zotero and all these other things. But it still creates this division between the true knowledge production process and the knowledge consumption process. And that, to me, is where the big disconnect is. What we are going to run into, if we constantly look at having a world of producers, whether they're faculty writing articles, whether they're content producers making gorgeous videos or writing books or making apps or what have you, and consumers on the other end, where we teach people how to find stuff that already exists, we're going to have this constant disconnect between documents and consumption. And what we're finding, why we're pushing towards apps, why we're pushing past the idea of documents and containers, is because people want to push past consumption. Those students that are in the classroom, we ask faculty, Sage, by the way, looks like a gorgeous product, please call me, I want to talk. But at the same time, what we're talking about is that the professors are going to set up these things and then the students are going to consume them on their own time. And I'll tell you what students come back to me and tell me when I point to videos like that is, yeah, I guess I watched it. And it's about as much retention as they get after reading the chapter I sent them. But if I send them out to make a video, or I send them out to remix a video, or I send them to do a report on what they learned by cutting and pasting multiple videos together, it is a fundamentally different learning experience. What we're finding is that the idea of a Netflix for education doesn't work, because education isn't based on consumption, it's based on learning, and learning is based on conversation. It's based on participation. So if you want to know from my perspective what the future of e-cont distribution is, from academic settings, from publishers, from libraries, from all of these groups, the idea is it's not about content dissemination. It is not about e-content being put on the web. It is about building platforms to support learning. Everything's a learning platform. It's not just Blackboard is a learning platform, or the Moodle is a learning platform, and we plug other things into it. Everything becomes a learning platform. Everything becomes focused on conversation. Now, I'm not the first to say this. I would like to point out a really much more brilliant person than me, Joan Bechtel, in 1986, said the following. Perhaps it is an overstatement to say that academic librarians are drifting in a vast sea of information and technological advances, searching for an appropriate course of action. Nevertheless, we appear to have lost the stabilizing rudder of confidence in who we are and what we do. As a more powerful alternative to the image of librarianship already available or proposed, I suggest that we begin to think of libraries as centers for conversation and of ourselves as mediators of and participants in the conversations of the world. 1986. What we're looking at is that as we begin to think about the notion of how people learn, and we go back all the way to Socrates, and if you want to keep going back that further, we can imagine it, though we can't necessarily document it. We look at the importance and primacy of a participatory function called conversation. And we can look at things like conversation theory. This is Gordon Pask looking terribly perplexed, probably about what his eyebrows are doing. And he came up with this whole notion of conversation theory. And he talks about what is a conversation. It consists of the conversants, the people who are interacting, participating, the language they use back and forth, the agreements that they seek to reach through that language, and a memory of those agreements over time. So if we say things like, as I began with, what's a book? And I say there's a lot of debate over that. Well, who's having that debate? Publishers have that debate. Librarians have that debate. Archivists have that debate. Academics have that debate. Collectors have that debate. People who auction off books and materials have that debate. They're the conversants. And there's a whole specialized language. What's the difference between a book and a manuscript and a serial and an edition? And what do those things mean? And they come to agreements. Well, can we agree that if it's bound together and it's sequential, that that's a book? All right, let's agree on that. Now, if that's true, is text important or can it be images? Well, let's talk about that. And the point is, there's conversations going on. And this is what academics and the scholarly press have always been about. That what's happening is that we're having a discussion about library science, physics, criminology. We're having a discussion about what does it mean to serve people in a political science context? What is radical and outside of normal conversation? How do we deal with race relations and diversity? How do we deal with the latest pulsar discoveries? And is there such a thing as Hawkins information? All of these are conversations and the academic foment that goes on. Now, how this helps us is that if we, instead of thinking about capturing the end of that, the article, the book, the synthesis, the video, the ta-da at the end of it, instead of focusing on the end product, really the artifact that pops out, the fossil of true thought, instead of focusing on that, if we instead focus on the discussion, on the thought itself, life changes dramatically. We begin to move into a world of complexity, but a complexity that makes sense. This is some images out of the Atlas of New Librarianship. I just bring them up as one example, which is the idea of concept maps, where if you think about a journal, and instead of thinking of a journal as, well, we've got volume numbers, and we've got run numbers, and then we've got article pages within, and we look at it as this thing that can be dissected. If you look at it as an ongoing sequential conversation over the history of a field, life changes. Because instead of looking at the front piece of books and documents about who wrote it and when it was written and these kinds of things, if you look at the back and its index and its citations and its footnotes, that's where the real interesting stuff is. Because then you begin to see who influenced whom. You begin to see how this word situates itself in different domains, how we create and carve out domains. We look at Kuhn's work on paradigms of scientific investigation, in which he said, you know, it's really interesting. You have this mainstream of people, and they all cite each other, and they all talk. And then around the edges, you've got the people who are new to the domain, and they begin to find cracks. And they begin to ask questions that you weren't supposed to ask. And suddenly, this burst where the mainstream gets broken, new theories are all thrown together, and suddenly they recoalesce in a new world. That's the fascinating, amazing part of scholarship. That's what we need to be teaching our students, because if we simply say, here are the facts, we know those facts are going to change in 5 to 10 years. What we teach middle schoolers, we think is going to be durable for what? 70 years? 80 years? The information we teach high schoolers, we'll give it 50 years, because chemistry tends to change every so often, and astronomy and physics is changing pretty rapidly. But once you get into college, 10 years? 5 years? If you're in a master's degree, 2 years? If you're in a PhD, you actually know less than when you started the program? That's because we're teaching people to constantly change and relearn, not simply consume the facts. And that's this idea of looking at scholarship. When you look at the new standards that ACRL is proposing, the Association for College and Research Libraries, around information literacy, scholarship is a conversation. And what we've been looking at in a consumption model and an e-content model, and we have a book and we have a journal, is we've been looking at the end phase of it, but that conversation happens throughout. By moving to a conversation or participatory focus where we build platforms that that watch, affect, and prepare these kind of things throughout, we move to a true graph in publications. Right? Every discovery system wants to be a Google-like interface, but it always fails. Why does it fail? It fails because we take document-like blobs and we've ignored the connection information, the citation information, the usage information through circulation, the online usage, and we just sort of say, yeah, we'll get that later. That's the stuff that holds it together. Citations become weighted links. Corpora become maps of conversation and thoughts and not simply collections that can be bought and purchased and provided. We move beyond simply connecting metadata to moving and collecting the thoughts themselves. Still a mentor of mine, Chuck McClure, once told me that the three best ways to be cited are to say it first, you're the seminal article, you pointed, you started the world. Say it last, you were the summary article, I can just simply point to you and people can follow that line of thought. Or say it stupid, because if they're going to counter you and say, that's stupid, they have to at least cite you. Well, in old tenure and old citation metrics in Web of Science world, that's what we could get at, was one of those three occurred. What we really want to get at are the first two, and we kind of want to know about the third as the third. Well, we can begin doing that if we move beyond the metadata and we actually look at the content of the citation, and we can publish then beyond scholarship. In an academic world, we can push e-content and scholarship past the end result of research and into the actual foment that makes scholarship work. That scholarship is a conversation. Lane Wilkinson had a really interesting discussion about this where he said, I'm not so sure. Because, you know, it means published for lots of different reasons, and is it really a conversation? Do we agree? But the point is, it should be. Good scholarship starts in an office where some researcher goes, that's when our e-content system should kick in. As they begin searching and say, did someone else figure this out? How about this? As they begin formulating ideas, as they begin throwing it off of their compatriots, as they begin emailing around and talking to graduate assistants and talking to freshmen and going, does this make sense? And then they begin putting instruments together and they begin collecting data of that instrument. That data then becomes associated with the instrument, becomes associated with their investigation, becomes associated with them. That foment, we can capture it now and begin to make sense of it. That instead of waiting for someone to be declared a genius and done and therefore approach them with a contract to publish, we can say, let's just start following you. Digital scribes that follow the process and make it easy for me to do research and for you to take that research, implement in your classes, implement it in your studies, implement it in your business model. And we can look at this not only in scholarship, we can look at this through the maker culture. And as people begin to design new invention, new companies, entrepreneurship, where we can begin to facilitate the conversation of what they're doing. The future of publishing and libraries and publishers is not in the stuff. It's platforms of conversation, not platforms of content delivery. Many people have heard of the idea of the library as platform. I've talked about the idea of a library as platform. But there are a few different takes on that. Some people talk about, with, say, the Digital Public Library of America, and the idea that what a platform is a series of APIs so that we can consume metadata and objects and move metadata and build new apps. And really what that is a platform for content distribution. And that's useful, and that's great, but that's not enough. That what we're finding is that will be useful until the Digital Public Library of America changes its APIs and new standards come on and they begin to lose attention or lose funding and all these kinds of things, and we're back into the day of the darkness coming. But if we look instead as a platform for conversation enhanced by content, enhanced by APIs, enhanced by this type of metadata, but ultimately focused on the discovery of new knowledge, new information, new application, life becomes radically more interesting. This platform needs to deliver content and context. Who said this? I mean, we talk about MOOCs. One of my favorite MOOC stories was when they wanted to take a lecture series produced out of Harvard on social justice and use it in another university on the West Coast that will remain nameless. And the faculty got together and said, you know what, this doesn't work for us. Having social justice conversation in an elite Ivy League institution with mostly white males in the audience doesn't really fit our need. It wasn't that they questioned the content. It was the context in which the discussion was occurring. Can we capture that context as well? Can we, as those documents move from environment to environment to environment, from use to use to use, from course to course to course, from scholar to practitioner to businessman to craftsman, track and create a story around the impact of that information? So we need to talk about a platform that delivers content and context, that's geared towards learning, not consumption. That it itself is, every piece of content has to have a course around it, has to have a piece of assessment around it, and done, frankly, taking a step back, in an ethical, value-driven way. We're already in the era of the data-driven student, where we look as freshmen increasingly not as people who come in with rights and responsibilities, but as data points that can inform strategies for marketing and instruction and all the good stuff, but all the potentially bad stuff as well. And nowhere really in the application process did we ask them if they were willing to be guinea pigs. That might be problematic. This idea that data can inform what we do is true, But it's the narratives and the stories that we use the data within that become more important. We need to talk about platforms that are geared towards production, not simply distribution. We need to begin to think of how we do and what we do, not simply as we produce content and it's not our job to worry about the consumption of that content. We need to talk about we provide capability and we provide potential, and it is our job in partnership with publishers, to libraries, to academics, to students, to companies, to public libraries, to school libraries, to say it is our job to help you release this content potential. When I, once again, I'm back over in Special Collections this morning, and they have these amazing tablets, these etched tablets that are tiny, fit in the palm of your hand, and they're 4,000 years old. And they talk of taxes, and they talk of inventory, but for 4,000 years, those things have survived, and in some of them, there are fingerprints. 4,000-year-old fingerprints, it suddenly creates a connection to the person looking at it, to seeking to understand it. And not only has the special collection preserved it and taken a picture of it, but they've worked to create K-12 lesson plans so the 10th grader can be smashed by a 4,000-year-old idea and how it influences today. The fact that some of those tablets exist because not we kept them and we kept them pristine, but because they were made of clay. And as people came to destroy civilization and rape and pillage and such, they burned the storehouses of information, which rather than destroying this content information, forged it into brick that would last through millennia of use and transfer and abuse. That kind of storyline, that's what our e-platforms need to capture. That's the stories we need to be able to tell. Rather than simply looking at producing an academic Netflix that people can sit back and consume, we need to talk about unleashing their potential to come up with the next idea and capture the next idea and bring around people who have that passion to understand to take that idea beyond where we ever thought we could take it. Acts of learning and conversation. Reading, citing, and organizing and sharing are acts of learning and conversation. Reading is making, is sense-making if you want to go into the academic side of things, but is making in the maker sense of the world. We need to concentrate and prepare and focus on the making, not just of professors and not just of the businessman and not just of the video producer, but of the student and the eighth grader and the person sitting in Africa with a cell phone connection. We need to focus on communities and members, not buyers and users. The reason academic journals have existed, some of them for multiple hundreds of years, is because there is an active member community that comes together and says it's important. We need to talk about people not as users, where they come and use you, but as members who contribute. We need to look at platforms where they put up video and they say, I have a great idea, let me put up a video and let me have a place to talk about that video and let me bring my friends into that conversation. Great studies done out of the UK where they set loose undergraduates into online database environments and they asked them, what'd you think? And their answer was, it was quiet. Now, as old-time catalogers, we might be thrilled by that because noise reduction is one of the things we worry about. But what they meant was, I didn't see all my friends there. I didn't see the markers that I'm used to having someone say, oh, look at this, and hey, this is important, and hey, this tried for me. Facebook and Twitter, these are really collaborative search and production engines that we need to look at them as the social function and not simply as, oh, we can download all the tweets and we can put some sort of social graph on them. So we need to look at the future in terms of this platform. We need to look beyond linked metadata to linked ideas and linked people. We need to look beyond content to context and meaning and understand that those aren't the same thing. That when you write a book, you have not produced knowledge. You have produced an artifact that you hope triggers knowledge production. And you've done your best to organize it and prepare it. But as we've all learned, when you put something out in writing, there are plenty of people who are willing to take it and put it in a totally different context and a totally different meaning. Does your content distribution platform take that into account? Does it allow people? What do we do with dissenting voices? What do we do in commingling and bringing these voices together and get rid of internet trolling and turn it into conversation and production in a scholarly or at least civic manner? We need to move beyond information to knowledge and action. What is information? If it's semantically understandable, does that make it information? If it's text, is that information? If it's spoken word, is that information? We know in many fields, paintings are information. The leaf is information. The weather is information. Information doesn't help us discern what we do. Knowledge, what's in people's head, what affects their behavior, what we can test and assess, how we can give them some function and see how they perform on it, that's what the body we need to be in. And simply abdicating that to a professor out there, or simply abdicating that to someone who's going to take our tool and do something with it, isn't good enough anymore. We need to see this sucker across the entire thing, from birth to use to reuse to reuse. We need to move beyond discovery to epiphanies. We need to move beyond the idea that we can find articles and pretend that therefore learning has occurred. We need to move beyond some sort of false security in the fact that we can produce documents around a topic and say that somehow we brought light to the topic. We need to stop documenting the world and start changing it. The future of e-content, the future of e-learning, the future of e-books, the future of all learning and books and knowledge and content in general is our ability to make the world a better place because of it. There is a social aspect. There is an advocacy aspect. We can no longer pretend that there is a neutrality simply because it's an HTML file that we can pass from one hand to another. If we choose the visualizer, if we choose the what we preserve and what we don't, if we choose the video format, if we choose the APIs that we bring together, if we choose to work within a walled garden or not, those are still choices that will affect people's ability to learn and change and understand. E-content is really e-advocacy. The notion that we publish something for a reason. We made some declaration of its importance. If nothing, then it's commercial declaration of importance. And I think we can go far beyond that. I think this is not a call for some utopian future where all documents and materials are produced in a sort of collective, in a free, utopian-like environment. No, I think this is a mixed market and a valuable market where money is to be made. But that money is to be made from understanding and true knowledge, not simply delivery and walk away. That we look at e-content and e-production and we see it as a vital part of everything we do in every environment, whether you're a politician, whether you're a librarian, whether you're a professor, whether you're a craftsman, whether you put up tile at the end of the day, there is knowledge to be had and shared and understood and a way that we can all work together. And if you want to talk about the future of this, it has nothing to do with an API and everything to do with the social movement of moving beyond the idea of documents and into the world of people. I thank you for your time and effort, and I believe we have time for questions.